Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Marcellaro, and this week my guest is himself, the producer and host of the Mac Voices podcast, Chuck Joyner. Chuck, welcome. Thank you for being on the show.
Thank you, John. It's an honor to be here.
Well, this is awesome. I love this because, you know, I've been on your show several times, and it's so cool to be able to have you on my show and learn more about you. Because I've always been amazed when I'm on your show, you have this wonderful demeanor. You're so calm and you're so professional and you listen so well and you keep peace among the people on the show and you make sure everybody has their turn and you ask the best questions and keep the conversation going. So I'm in awe of your skills about this and I'm happy to have you on the show.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. That's high praise coming from you. So it's always a pleasure to have you on.
Well, thank you. Thank you. So one of the things, as you know, in Background Mode, and as the listeners know, is we are quasi-biographical, at least for the first half of the show. And so I wanted to help the listeners understand how you got where you are. We talked before the show about how you are an insurance executive in Pennsylvania. But that's the short version. I want to go back and take some time and have you tell us what was happening before you ascended to that position and how you got involved in that. And as we'll find out in a minute, that helps us understand how you got into the video podcasting.
Okay. Well, I guess depending on how far back we want to go.
I was born at an early age, so
Yeah. There's always that line. I went to college and studied accounting and came out with the absolute conviction that the one thing I did not want to do was accounting, and because it's just it, great business background education, but it just wasn't my thing. So I decided to get into insurance claims and investigation with the intent of I get to see inside a lot of different kind of businesses and industries.
In college, you did this?
After college. And, you know, just because you had to come out and find a job somehow. And so figured I'd find another career by doing some research, some practical research. Okay. And as a result, just stumbled into something that I absolutely loved, and that was claims investigation and handling. Started out like everybody does, you know, with auto and property and the smaller stuff. And eventually,
so you were an adjuster in the early days?
Yeah. Or representative, depending on, you know, what company you talk to. And work my way up strictly in claims. That's always been my love. I've never sold insurance. That's not my thing. But work the way up to heavy liability, workers' comp, environmental, bond, litigation.
Slow down a second now. So in your early days as an insurance claims agent, we normally think, I don't want to get off track, but we normally think of adjusters and insurance agents as somebody who gives the customer kind of a tough time in terms of, you know, settling the insurance claim. I doubt that ever happened to you because you're so equanimous and professional and cool. But did you run into that psychology of that part of the job?
You know, John, it's one of those things that I think that part of the industry gets a bad rap. Mm-hmm. I've met so few people that really have that attitude. They have the attitude of paying what is owed. That's usually where the dispute part comes in, is paying, you know, people understanding what their policy is supposed to be paying them. So if you, for example, if you have a 10-year-old TV set, you probably aren't owed a new, brand new TV set unless you bought the right coverage. And that's where I think the reputation gets in, is okay, we're going to try to pay the least amount possible. That was never the game. You know, the game is to pay what is owed. And that's where you go back to the insurance contract.
Based on the level of your premiums and how long you paid them and the calculation of what the company owes you based on the age of the product or the car.
Yeah, but it's all right. what people don't understand about it is that it's not an insurance policy. That's what the industry calls it, but it's an insurance contract, and everybody understands a contract. So if the contract says this is what you get, then that's what you're supposed to get. And that's the kind of the key part as far as understanding it. And it was amazing how many times that if you used that line and made people really read what it was that they had purchased, a lot of the disagreements disappear quickly.
Did you see the 60 Minutes last Sunday about life insurance policies, where a whole laundry list of companies are not paying people when they paying their beneficiaries when the policyholder dies?
No, I missed that. Yeah, check that out.
They're waiting for the beneficiaries to figure out that you had a policy and then file a claim and then go through all the paperwork and then beg for the money. And if you don't do that, they keep the money and invest it.
Yeah. Yeah, those are the kind of things that give the industry a bad name, unfortunately.
So somewhere along the way, you moved up into the current position. Tell us how that happened.
I'd been on the company side for a long time, never thought I'd be on the agency side. And then a former boss of mine had moved over to the agency side and started a group of independent agents called the Insurance Alliance, and called me and asked me if I'd like to be involved in the operation. And that's how I moved to the agency side. And that's where I've been now for 15 years, managing and working with our member agencies to help service their clients from a claims perspective.
One of the things you told me was that you've developed this particular skill of listening to people as part of the investigation, and that has served you well in Mac Voices, I must say.
It's funny. If you ask people questions and then stop and let them answer and listen, they'll tell you what you need to hear, and sometimes they'll tell you a lot more. So it really is, I think, a skill that has indeed served me well on the podcasting side.
Did using computers as part of your work lead you into a technical interest of doing other things with computers, or did that come separately?
No, that came very separately and actually ahead of the industry, because the insurance industry back at that time was not terribly known for the technology at the street level and, you know, in the front lines. So I very much had an interest. The first things I bought when I got out of college and got a job, I bought a VCR and I bought an Apple IIe. Those were the first two things that I wanted, and immediately became hooked on the Apple ecosystem at that time. And I was always intrigued by the ability, not as much the programming. I know a lot of people get into the programming. My thing was all the things I could do that this would let me do better, faster, more. And that's kind of been my whole interest always.
VisiCalc, perhaps?
I'm sorry?
VisiCalc, perhaps, the original spreadsheet on the Apple II?
VisiCalc, but also word processing, desktop publishing, you know, just the idea that I can type a lot faster than I can write, because I'm a touch typist, and the idea that you could do things once and then have them repeat with VisiCalc and, you know, some of these subsequent spreadsheets. The whole thing, it's just an empowering device, and that's the way I've always seen it.
Did that lead you to agitating for better use of computers within the insurance group you were with?
Oh, yeah.
Tell me now that your adjusters go out to the scene with an iPad and they sit there and tap and tap and tap. Tell me, please.
Well, it depends on the company, but you know, they have caught up, and you know, but I was one of those people that was sneaking the equipment in the back door and putting it on my desk. I had an Apple IIc on my desk at one point, and was the only person with anything that resembled a personal computer on the desk. But again, it was because it made my life easier and I could do more and be more efficient.
So right after you got your Apple II, I know that you joined a users group.
Yep, I joined the Hershey Apple Corps in Hershey, Pennsylvania, and found a bunch of kindred spirits. You know, some were more technical than I was, but and obviously at that point, a lot of those people were very, very advanced compared to the where I was. But I always enjoyed the meetings. I loved the user group world because it was about exchanging information. And so eventually got involved in the leadership of the group. The president.
The leadership of the group. Yeah, I know how that goes. Who wants to be president of the user group? Not me. Ask Chuck. Maybe he'll take the job.
Yeah, the line they used on me was, we'll run the meeting, but we will run the group, but we just need somebody to lead the meetings.
Yeah.
Okay, I can lead meetings. Well, then that's how it started. And from there, it kind of went uphill or downhill, depending on your point of view.
So then there came serving as chairman of Apple's users group advisory board back around 2000. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I'd been going to Macworlds in Boston and San Francisco for a while and had gotten to know the then user group program manager, Diane Cohn, at Apple. And she called me up one day and said, you know, she was thinking of forming this advisory board and would I be interested? And I said, you know, absolutely. I mean, you know, first of all, it was an honor. But second, it was Apple. Who wouldn't want? And then she said, well, would you be interested in being chairman? And it's like, sure. I don't know what you want, but, you know, we'll take a shot at it. And so served on that for 4.5 years. During that time, we did user group advocacy for Apple and in the community.
A lot of people don't think that Apple reaches out very much to listen to users groups and customers, but this is a shining example.
Yeah, and back then, things were a bit different in every area. I mean, there were no Apple stores and user groups. I mean, Guy Kawasaki famously had gone out to user groups and really evangelized things and gotten it rolling a long time before, you know, the advisory board was formed. And we put on user group universities at Macworlds on both coasts to help teach and encourage leaders to get involved and perpetuate the groups and keep
them
going.
So was that a Macworlds session where you actually invited user group leaders to come to a session at Macworld and learn how to lead a users group?
No, those were separate events, completely standalone separate events, just scheduled either right before or slightly overlapping Macworld. So the idea was, if you're coming to Macworld, come a day or two early,
okay,
participate in this, and, you know, have some fun.
How long did that last?
Those went, I think they did one or two after I left. So it probably went into 2005, maybe early 2006. But toward the end of those events, they turned into a little bit different focus as opposed to the training. But it was, you know, it was a good run, and user groups were important, and they're important now. They're not as popular, I think, or quite as many in number.
Let me ask you about that. Somebody told me the other day that it was their perception that users groups were a bunch of older people who were still interested in learning and wanted to socialize, and that young people didn't regularly attend their meetings. They were doing something else, or they thought they knew everything they needed to know. How do you feel about that?
I think there's some truth to it. You know, unfortunately, because the younger people grew up on the internet, so they really don't need those groups, and they have different forms of socialization. When I look back, I don't think any of us realized at that time how important the socialization aspect of user groups was. We were so focused on learning, but we enjoyed the company of each other. And so, yeah, there's definitely been a graying of user groups, and, you know, I think the social aspect has become more important and more recognized now. But that doesn't mean they're any less fun to go to, I can tell you that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. There's one here near Denver that I go to, McIntech, and people are great, and just it's a fabulous session, and everybody's very technical, and we get together and go to Panera Bread first and have some dinner and chat and talk, and it's a great time.
Yeah, somehow there's always food involved, which is a good thing.
Yeah, yeah. So tell me about mugcenter.com.
The Mug Center was the first website I started. That started back shortly after I became the chairman of the advisory board. simply because I felt like there was information that needed to get out there. There were stories to be told that user from the user group community's perspective. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there were a lot of restrictions with what could and could not be put on Apple's site, and so I decided to start up an independent site, and it's evolved. It's morphed into different things over the years. Right now, it exists primarily as a way for groups to help publicize their meetings. They send me their meetings, or I go out and surf their websites and list the meetings. And of course, if they have they have respected speakers like John Martawero, I make sure I highlight that. So it's
oh,
a way
please.
it's a way for me to kind of keep my hand in the user group community and maintain that connection that I really love so much.
Cool. Well, I think this is a really good time to take a break. And in fact, you know what's coming because you've listened to some of the shows.
We get to hear from Kelly.
That's right. Kelly's up next. We're going to take a short break. Folks, we'll be right back. Stay with us.
Hello there, all you fabulous background mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
And we're back. Thank you, Kelly. That was awesome. All right. So now I want to transition into the second segment of the program, flash forward to the current day, or at least the days when you started doing these video podcasting. Were they always video? I want to hear the story about how you got into this, because I'm new to the podcasting business myself, and all I'm technically equipped to do right now is audio podcasts. And I've always been amazed that you've been able to pull together these multi-window, multi-person video podcasts that are just amazing. And it takes some technical expertise and an extreme amount of passion and interest to pull that together and make it work. So I want to hear the story of how you got from your Macs into the video business and what inspired you to do this.
Okay. Well, we go back again to the user group thing. My very first show was called the User Group Report, and it obviously was focused on user groups. At that time, I felt like user groups did a lot of great things, but they seldom publicized anything they did outside of their local communities. And so this was a way for me to help promote the cause, if you will. And that went on for a few years. And as I started to run out of user group stories, and I'd also morphed the show a little bit and had people on like Brian Chaffin and Adam Angst.
That was video even in those days?
No, that was audio.
Oh,
that
okay.
was that was very rough audio. I mean, this is when the tools just didn't exist. Mm-hmm. In fact, I will tell you the truth that some of those first shows were produced with me having one microphone talking into it and then having a speakerphone with another microphone just hovering over the speakerphone so I could record the audio
stone
of the other person.
Stone Age. Stone
Absolutely
Age.
Stone Age. Absolutely. So As things were kind of coming to an end and podcasting was starting to become a thing, I podcast got listed in the iTunes store, I started to get emails from people saying, you know, I'm really not into user groups, but I stumbled across your show and really like it. And I realized that I had a bit of an identity problem. So it's one of those things, you know, one morning in the shower, the idea of Mac Voices popped into my head. So I called Adam Angst and said, you know, hey, I'm changing the show and I'm going to start, and I'd like for you to be on a regular basis. And he said, well, that's great. But he
Is
said,
it because
you know,
you knew Adam well and you thought that'd be a good person to be comfortable with on the show?
Yeah, exactly. And And it was, you know, more just, he wasn't supposed to be like a partner or anything. It was just going to be one of those regular guests that I planned to have. And he said, well, you know, there are a lot of people in the Mac industry that don't know about this podcasting thing, but would love to get into it. And so, you know, you might want to think about approaching them. So I launched Mac Voices, and then a week later, I launched Mac Notables. And Mac Notables, and I got to make sure I do a roll call. Mac Voices was always supposed to be just what we're doing, one-on-one, or occasionally two-on-one, but about a specific topic or product or event or whatever. Mm-hmm. Mac Notables was a closed panel, and I got to run the list so to make sure I don't leave anybody out. But the panel was Chris Breen, Brian Chaffin, Jim Dalrymple, Adam Angst, Tanya Angst, Dan Frakes, Andy Inoko, Ted Landau, Bob Levitis, Dennis Sellers, Jason Snell, and Robin Williams.
And those, what a if you're, group. What a stellar group of people.
That's why it was called Mac Notables.
Yes, sir.
So, you know, so the two shows ran concurrently for a while. You know, sometimes we'd have more Mac Notable shows, sometimes more Mac Voices shows, but they kept rolling. The one thing I didn't have at that point was a panel show, though. So in about March of 2008, I started the Mac Jury, which was always only a panel show of three, four, sometimes more. And by the way, all this is audio up to this point, because the video, I mean, the internet just didn't support video like it does now. And those were all separate identities, separate websites, and it became a challenge. So then video
became... I think
became,
that's about where I came in, because I remember being on a Mac jury once. We were talking about some event, trying to figure out how the jury members felt about something.
Exactly. And it was a lot of fun to have different people on and exchanging the ideas. And then video started to get in there a little bit. And in 2009, I started experimenting with video. Some shows would be audio, some would be video, depending on what the other people's setups were. Because, of course, a lot of people didn't have video cameras or didn't have an internet connection that would support decent video. So it got to be... At that point, it got to be a bit of a jumbled mess. In 2013...
Did that cause some inconsistency in your planning in the shows, because some people could be on video and some people couldn't? Did that create kind of a planning headache?
Sure. And frankly, some people were willing to be on video and others really didn't want to be on video. You know, there's that whole camera thing that scares people. I don't understand it. So,
or we scare them.
Well, yeah, there's that. So I ran for a while doing that. And then in 2014, I realized that, okay, a couple things have to happen. You know, I really want to go all video, because it just, I think it enhances the experience. And I absolutely still publish in audio, and there are plenty. I have a lot of subscribers that only listen to the audio. But I think the video lets them see you and see me, and they get to know, and they see when we're cracking jokes with each other, and when somebody makes a sharp comment, it's done with a twinkle in the eye, and then everybody piles on the other person, and it's more fun than anything else. So in 2014, I switched over. I consolidated everything into Mac Voices, the Mac Voices brand, froze the other websites in place, and move forward.
So these shows have always been free for anyone to come and listen to, right?
Absolutely.
It's a labor of love to do all this, and as a contribution to the community.
Well, John, no, you know what? It's a little bit more selfish than that, because I want to talk to these people. I like you and Brian and everybody. And so this is a way for me to sit down and pick your brains and get that, some of that old user group experience,
Chuck,
back in
the I'm finding that out. I'm finding that out myself. You know, this podcast thing is of interest to the listeners, because the shows are entertaining and you get good guests on. But just like you, I've discovered it's an awful lot of fun to get to know these people better, people who you've known about for a long time. You get to hear a little bit about their history. I don't want to name any particular guests, but everybody has a fascinating story to tell. We only know them in this frozen moment of time. We see them on the byline of their articles at some website, and we go, wow, I've always known that person. And then you realize, no, I really don't know that person, until you get them on the show and we chat about their lives. It's awesome.
And you know, okay, so there's Joe Smith Software out there, and you just think, well, you know, that must be a big company or whatever. And then you find out it's two guys in a garage, literally, who, you know, put this piece of software out that you just dearly love or you depend on. And so you get them and you let the audience see them and hear them and know that they're two guys that really care about it. And I think it changes your attitude toward the products you buy and the people you interact with and the way you interact with them.
Absolutely. Getting to know people personally and hearing their story helps you in any interaction you might have with the company and what you're trying to do. You know, it generates a certain amount of camaraderie and respect, as opposed to this just company in the sky that I don't know why they're doing what they're doing to me.
Yeah. And it's been a really great ride, because I find that some of my best friends have been developed through doing this, and some of my best friends don't live in my town, my city, my state. Mm-hmm. Some of them don't live in my country, but they're still great friends. And you know, I know them very well. They know me very well. We get together at conferences whenever we have the opportunity. So it's just been a very, very positive experience overall.
I'm going to jump off the script here for a second and ask you a question out of the blue. You don't have to answer it. Who has been the most stellar, most notable, interesting guest that you've ever had on? Something funny happened, or somebody who was really famous you didn't expect to snag on the show? You don't have to answer, but I'm curious.
No, you know what? I'll say something that I'd said on the little blurb I did for our 10th anniversary. You know, people always ask me who my favorite guest was, and it's all of them. It's all of them, because otherwise they wouldn't be on the show, because I don't invite anybody on the show that I don't want to talk to, that I'm not interested in, in their product or whatever. So, you know, there have been some moments that never made it into broadcast, when somebody expresses an opinion that is maybe a little too passionate. I distinctly remember one individual expressing a political opinion about a particular Secretary of Defense that just didn't seem appropriate to broadcast on the show.
Did you have to garage band him out of the
but I still have that clip, and it'll come in handy one day.
Well, is there any, without naming names, of course, is there, of course, have you ever had anybody turn you down and say, you know, I don't want to be on your show?
No, you know, the biggest struggle, I think, is getting people to respond, and especially when it comes to software houses and all, because you don't know exactly who to invite. If I contact you and invite you directly, hardly ever get a flat cold turn down. Mm-hmm. But sometimes you're sending an email off into the void or into a contact form, and hey, I'd really like to have you on the show to talk about your product, and there's just no response, which always intrigues me. My only conclusion can be that either they don't like the show, or they are afraid of the camera. I try to do a friendly interview, a calm interview, an informative interview. I don't want to be Mike Wallace and ambush anybody. That's not what it's about. Mm-hmm. Not for me.
I have found that some guests are busy in a way that makes them elusive and hard to get them scheduled. And then there are other people who you can schedule a month in advance, and 2 minutes before the show, they're right there. It's in the calendar. They were ready.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
We will never run out of great people to talk to, because there's so many great people just constantly coming to this, or we just find out about their projects. So I foresee this going on for a long time.
Can you tell us about any notable guests you have planned for the future, or do you not do that?
No, I'd rather not, because you never know when schedules or whatever might shoot them in the foot. And
yeah, same here.
Life happens occasionally. I've had people that, you know, plan to be on, and then they disappear for 6 months. They come back and say, you know, I had a death in the family or something. And it's like, you know, that never bothers me, because that happens to all of us at one point or another.
Sure. In the few minutes we have left, I'd like to hear more about the technology that you use. Can you kind of give us a thumbnail sketch of how you pull this together, starting with, you know, Skype or whatever it is you use, and how you collect this video and how you put it together and upload a show? Just kind of give us a description of how all that goes and what hardware you use.
Sure. I have a 5K iMac, which is my current recording machine, with a Logitech C920 webcam for me. You're right. It's run on Skype because Skype is my favorite phrase is Skype is a harsh mistress. Mm-hmm. When she likes you, she likes you. When she doesn't, she doesn't.
Yes.
But overall, it does pretty good. I use the Ecamm call recorder software, and I capture the video stream. So the way that software works is it captures my video stream, and then it captures everybody else's video stream separately, and, of course, the audio as well. Then I'm able to split out all in the case of, let's say, a four-person interview. I obviously have my track separately. I'm able to split out then the other three video tracks.
I've seen that in real time, though. It's echoed back to me in Skype. I get to see all the people on the montage.
Yes, exactly.
And that Ecamm software is doing that for you.
Well, no, that's Skype doing that. It's just Ecamm is what's capturing it.
Oh, okay.
And I know some people just take that four up view and publish it, but I decided early on, no, I really want to be able to zoom in to you when you're speaking, or to mm-hmm. Jeff Gamet when he's speaking. So I split everything out, throw it all into Final Cut, and then do the typical video editing where I've got individual headshots, and then I've got a group shot, and then go through
So Final Cut allows you to select a segment where you explode that person's video and make them the main part of the screen.
Yeah, or look at it as just you have basically 5 separate video tracks.
Wow.
So one track is the group shot, one track is me, then one track is you, then the other one is guest number two, and the other one's guest number three, and then you just cut back and forth in a multicam, what they call a multicam edit, between, you know, based on whoever's speaking or whoever you want to show. So it ends up being a reasonably polished production, or at least I think a visually more interesting production than just having, you know, four talking heads all on the screen at the same time.
And then you save that as a video file and post it to your site.
Yep, save that as a video file. And then right now I'm publishing to, I used to publish the video files on Blip TV, but Blip went away. So now I publish on YouTube and Vimeo, and then post the audio to SoundCloud, as well, of course, as the video and audio RSS feeds for the podcasts.
How long does it take you to put a show together? I mean, to do the post-production?
You know, somebody said that it probably takes a minute. Well, no, that's not right. It takes another 2 to 2.5 times the running time of the show.
Mm-hmm.
By the time you know, because basically that means I have to watch the entire show over again and do the edits, and then throw in the lower third titles and the intros and outros and all.
Right.
And then,
right, that is a labor of love, I must say.
Well, it's a labor of love, but you know, it's a product that if I'm going to put it out, I want to put it out right. And so that's what I do.
I appreciate what you do. It's awesome.
Thank you.
It's awesome.
Thank you.
Well, I think we're about out of time. We've been going on here for quite a while, and this has been very interesting to hear about how you do what you do and to have your guest on my show. I really appreciate this.
John, I can't thank you enough for having me, and I'm looking forward to getting you back on the Mac Jury.
Okay, anytime. You've got me. Tell the listeners how to contact you if they wish.
Best place, of course, is macvoices.com. That's where you can find pretty much everything. And I'm on Twitter as @ChuckJoiner. That's J-O-I-N-E-R, @ChuckJoiner. And I do my best to respond to anybody that tweets at me.
Cool, cool. Well, listeners, I hope you enjoyed the show with Chuck and me, and I thank you for coming by. We'll see you next time on the Mac Observer's Background Mode.